From Nepal to North London, from Delhi to Dagenham, from the terraces to the armchair, it's an Arsenal Thing podcast. Football's in our DNA.
And welcome to It's an Arsenal Thing. I'm your host, Tom, and with me as always is a man who sneers at the idea of drinking in moderation. He scoffs at the thought of physical fitness at early nights, and he's deeply suspicious of soft cheeses. It can only be Silent Dave Hutchinson. Welcome, Potters. We have double portions on the show tonight. The game against the Candy Kings of the South Coast, Brighton, and Eddie Howe's resurgent Geordie Marauders, Newcastle. You already know how it went, but we're going to mull over it again with Connor in a two-part match report and going to get into it. I'm in the gun room with Paul and Lauren to reflect on the action and the performances. Who was hot and who was not? We bring you the worst man of the match awards in football, and they are corkers, aren't they, Dave? We reveal Arsenal's one-cap wonders for England. There's the musical interlude and all the usual nonsense. Well, let's kick off with rumours surrounding the future of the Chav Boy Wizard manager, Graham Potter, who might be sacked if he doesn't get a top four finish. And then there's Antonio Conte, who said recently he's happy, but he doesn't look it. Invite your face to the party. He said, I want to be honest. I want to be very clear. I've said this to the club. I have said my opinions. The fans deserve the best. Maybe to stay in fifth is the best. Maybe sixth or seventh or fifth or fourth is the best. He's off his rocker, isn't he? He's going to be on his gondola at the end of the season. Anyway, elsewhere, we discovered that Jurgen Klopp talks to his microwave about refereeing decisions.
Yeah, but that's actually exactly the same as I would talk to my microwave to get no response, really.
Oh, that's all you need, an opinionated microwave. Mikel Arteta does so much pacing up and down during a match, he's now getting through three pairs of shoes over 90 minutes. In the Newcastle game, he had to have a sweat transfusion, and one supporter thought that Spanish Michael was using semaphore to question the referee's parentage. That's one for Richard Keys, a squat, faded football anchor on a spit and sawdust football programme that no one watches, also featuring a shiny-headed, chuckling Scotsman as his girlfriend. The low point of the week was FIFA president Gianni Infantino, who stooped to a new low by taking a selfie just behind Pelé's open coffin. Shame on you, sir. Have some respect. And then he had the audacity to blame it on Pelé's teammates. Talk about throwing people under the bus. With the suggestion of a Wenger statue outside the Emirates, we ask, jacket zip up or down? Remember, the Arsenal boss had a string of technical issues with humble zip. In an article in October 2019, the Mail carried the story. Wenger said, with his French tongue pressed firmly in his cheek, "The coat was too long. I had cold hands. My technique must not have been great." He told that to Ben Miller of the Daily Mail. You may recall that the Frenchman had some difficulties on occasions with pockets as well. He's just not lucky with coats, is he? Constantly trying to find a recess and failing.
It's an Arsenal thing, it's an Arsenal thing. Believe it or not, it's an Arsenal thing. With football and transfers, you know you'll bring. You're listening to It's an Arsenal Thing.
It's time to go to Connor for the first part of a two-part Gonna Get Into It with the game against Brighton.
What a win, what a performance, a memorable victory to extend our lead to the top of the Premier League table to 7 points on what was a New Year's Eve to remember. We ended 2022, a very successful, memorable 2022, by beating a well-drilled Brighton and Hove Albion by 4-2 in the end in what was a thrilling encounter to move 7 points clear at the top of the Premier League. And well, Bukayo Saka netted after just 66 seconds. And what an assured, cool finish from the young Englishman who starred at the World Cup. He collected a deflected Gabriel Martinelli cross after Thomas Partey had won possession extremely well in midfield to get it on to Martinelli, who looked ever so dangerous and lively early on. He tried to pick out Nketiah actually, but the ball ricocheted kindly into Saka's path, and the Englishman produced a stunning first touch, a world-class first touch, and on the half-volley, just absolutely produced one of the best finishes I've seen in recent times. It looked so easy, actually, when you see it on the highlights, but Saka's finish is world-class. Sensational from Saka. He just slotted coolly into the back of the net, which was 66 seconds on the start. And, of course, Martin Odegaard, he scored his 7th league goal of the season just before half-time, which was quickly added to by Eddie Nketiah after the restart. Nketiah, 2 goals in 2 league outings now. Very impressive stat, that, for the Gabriel Jesus stand-in. Well, Robert De Zerbi's team did fight back, and they did give us a little bit of a scare. I was biting my nails. I was really, really nervous, especially when Brighton brought it back to 4-3 in the 88th minute. Thankfully, VAR ruled that goal offside. I was thinking, oh, here we go again, another Newcastle United 4-4. I know that on that occasion we were 4-0 to the good, and we were 4-1 up with 71 minutes on the clock here at the Amex Stadium on Saturday. But I felt as though a 4-4 draw could have been on the cards, and that just goes to show how much faith I have in my team. But Arsenal fans listening, I'm sure you'll know that unless the final whistle is blown, you cannot relax. Unless it's at 4-0 or 5-0. You know, it's just one of those things, one of those teams. It's the Arsenal. Oh, well. And, well, the very impressive Kairo Mitoma pulled 1 goal back, which was cancelled out then just 6 minutes later by Gabriel Martinelli. And then Irishman Evan Ferguson's effort made it game on, and it set up an interesting final 15 minutes or so going into the final stages. But Arsenal held on to ensure plenty of New Year's cheer for Gooners across the world. And well, in just the second minute then into the action, Thomas Partey dispossessed Tariq Lamptey in a dangerous area, and Alexander Zinchenko fed Gabriel Martinelli on the left-hand side, hugging the touchline and closing in on the Brighton 18-yard box. Martinelli saw a shot deflect off Lewis Dunk and kindly into Saka's path. As well, I thought it was, he was going for goal and also trying to perhaps play in Nketiah. It looked as though he was trying to arrow a shot towards the far corner, which he hoped Nketiah might get a nick to help the ball in. But well, luckily for Arsenal, it fell to Saka, who composed himself when it mattered most to steer us 1-0 up inside just 2 minutes. And well, 2 minutes later, we almost got a second when Alexander Zinchenko snuck in cleverly behind the Seagulls' back line. But Robert Sanchez narrowed the angle quickly to block a sensational reverse pass by Gabriel Martinelli, as we looked so, so sharp in the opening stages. But well, Brighton began to show why they were sitting in seventh place. Before kickoff, Aaron Ramsdale was forced to tip away a couple of awkward Leandro Trossard shots. Incidentally, Aaron Ramsdale was making his 50th appearance for Arsenal on Saturday. But well, with the game finally balanced at just 1-0 to the Gunners, Martin Odegaard slotted home in the 39th minute to score, as I say, his 7th league goal of the campaign. Very impressive figures for the Norwegian captain. Saka swung in a dangerous near post corner that was only headed away to the edge of the box, where Odegaard was lurking, and he shot into the ground, but luckily for us it bounced kindly into the back of the net and into the top corner, and that all important second gave us a nice cushion going into the break. And well, 2-0 at half time. We worked the ball well through midfield, and well, a fine pass from Thomas Partey in the 47th minute once again found Martinelli in a threatening position. Martinelli pulled the trigger and forced Sanchez into a low save, but the ball spun kindly into the path of Nketiah, who tapped home from close range. We look to be sailing towards victory, and only a good Sanchez save from Gabriel following a free kick kept it at 3-0. But on 65 minutes, and with their first real side of goal in the second half, Brighton managed to pull a goal back. Pascal Gross found himself in space in the final third and slid the ball into Mitoma, who managed to stay marginally onside and neatly slipped the ball past Aaron Ramsdale. That did inject some belief momentarily into Brighton's play and into the home crowd, but it was quickly extinguished by a sensational Martin Odegaard through ball. A dangerous ball across our own box was then dealt with by Gabriel, and the ball found its way to Odegaard via Granit Xhaka, and the Norwegian's pass is just mind-blowing. Breathtaking pass by Odegaard to unleash Martinelli, who raced through on goal to poke home past the Brighton goalkeeper to make it 4-1. And well, the skipper, of course, it was a sensational pass by our skipper. Brighton, though, wouldn't go away, and with only 14 minutes remaining, they managed to make it 4-2. Another mistake by William Saliba, allowing the Irishman Ferguson to nip in and squeeze the ball past the onrushing Aaron Ramsdale and over the line. Our nerves were jangling when, with just 2 minutes remaining, Mitoma thought he'd added his second and Brighton's third when he found the net from just inside the box again. A beautiful curling effort, which took a slight deflection. Thankfully, though, VAR ruled it out for offside. It was a tight call, but it was the correct decision. And when we managed to hang on, Mohamed Elneny, the reliable Egyptian midfielder, came on to shore up victory. Rob Holding also was brought on by Arteta. An impressive win for the Gunners at the Amex on New Year's Eve to extend our lead at the top of the table. It finished Brighton Hove Albion 2, Arsenal 4.
Can you name the worst man of the match awards in football? No, it's not a golden football figure on an onyx base or a juicy cheque for the charity of your choice. Think lower, subterranean. Well, Saeed Benrahma was given a copy of Crash Bandicoot for his man of the match performance once. Once upon a time, there was a player who received 5 gigs of data. What about this? In Zimbabwe, a professional footballer was given 24 beers for his man of the match performance. Aberdeen's Stephen Glass won a bike for being man of the match in the 1995 League Cup final. A team called Dreams FC in the Ghanaian Premier League give out sliders for the man of the match. It's nice to keep up the trends, isn't it? And finally, Argentinian international Franco Armani was handed a glorious Burger King Kids Club crown for his performance. No contest, is it? Oh, what a whopper. Part two of Gonna Get Into It with Connor. This time it's Eddie Howe's Newcastle.
Arsenal, for the first time this season, failed to score in a Premier League match. The first time in 17 games, as we struggled to create quality, clear-cut chances against Eddie Howe's impressive and resolute Newcastle defence. Two huge, contentious moments. Arsenal felt as though they should have had 2 penalties. One when Granit Xhaka's 90th minute cross, pretty much in the closing stages, hit the hand of a Newcastle defender. VAR deemed it unnecessary to go and check that one. And Gabriel had his shirt pulled in the penalty area from a corner on the hour mark. Oh well, Newcastle are third for a reason. They were resolute, they were dogged, organised. And apart from a late Eddie Nketiah shot, which was well saved by the Newcastle goalkeeper, we failed to look threatening. Martin Odegaard struggled. He was crowded out at times by the Newcastle midfield. But Eddie Howe, credit where credit is due. Newcastle stifled us and we had no answers. It is clear, of course, we are linked with Mudryk from Shakhtar Donetsk. And let's see whether or not Chelsea will hijack that deal. Hopefully we can get that deal done in January. Atletico Madrid's João Felix also linked with the Gunners in this January winter transfer window. It is clear, though, apart from Fabio Vieira, our bench looks very, very weak. We don't have the striking options, the attacking options in particular, to be able to change a game when we're struggling against an organised defence. But Newcastle came to the Emirates on Tuesday night, looking for the draw, and they got it. They're still within touching distance of us at the top. We did stretch our lead to the top of the table to 8 points before Manchester City face Chelsea at Stamford Bridge today at the time of recording. And Newcastle, after that draw, 9 points behind us in third. So in what was a quite the tempestuous encounter, Arsenal, as I say, failed to break down a league defence for the very first time this season. And while Arsenal's frustrations raised further in injury time, a late penalty appeal, of course, a handball from Jacob Murphy wasn't awarded by referee Andy Madley, and VAR didn't intervene. Arsenal boss Mikel Arteta, well, our manager was absolutely livid on the touchline, and rightly so. We have seen those given. Gary Neville and Paul Merson in the Sky Sports studio both agreed that it would have been harsh, but we have seen them given. Was Jacob Murphy's hand in a natural position, or was it slightly raised? I could argue both ways. The Arsenal players surrounding referee Andy Madley in injury time, Arteta labelled it a scandalous decision. And while the result further strengthened Newcastle's case for a top four finish, as they defended their box expertly, and their goalkeeper Nick Pope was absolutely terrific when called upon. Well, of course, Eddie Howe's side remained the best defence in the Premier League this season. They've conceded just 11 goals and they've kept 10 clean sheets. And well, it was Newcastle. Into the action then, it was the visitors that created the best chance in the opening stages. Just before the break, Joe Linton's header from 4 yards out somehow missed the target, much to Aaron Ramsdale and the Arsenal defence relief. Arsenal, of course, 8 points clear. Newcastle were just too determined, too dogged, as they repelled our in-form attack. And well, the team news then, we, of course, made just the one change to the 4-2 away win at Brighton on New Year's Eve. And that change saw Alexander Zinchenko come back in at left back for Kieran Tierney. And just the one change we made, and that was Takahiro Tomiyasu coming on in the closing stages. Well, of course, we took just 66 seconds to score at Brighton on New Year's Eve, and we were quick out of the marks once again. We actually created 5 shots. We had 5 shots on the Newcastle goal in 6 minutes, but the visitors somehow managed to withdraw the storm. They survived the early onslaught, did Newcastle. Well, Newcastle composed themselves rather impressively as the first half wore on and turned the encounter into their favour, and they made it difficult and uncomfortable for us. A scrappy game, really. Excellent pressure from the visitors in midfield, frustrating Arsenal, and in particular Martin Odegaard, who ran the show at Brighton a few days earlier. And well, it was an interesting, high-tempered game for sure. 5 bookings across both teams in 16 minutes as the halftime whistle drew ever closer. With Arsenal struggling to find any composure, Newcastle almost hit them with a sucker punch on the counter-attack. But Joe Linton could not convert from 4 yards out from Fabian Schär's near-post header. And well, Schär, speaking of that man, he looped a header inches over Ramsdale's crossbar just after the break, as Newcastle's threat on the break and from set pieces were causing Arsenal a big problem. Arsenal remained tidy in possession, but Newcastle's defence stood strong when asked to protect their goalkeeper. Martinelli thought he had flicked home what would have been a monumental goal in the title race late on when meeting a near-post corner, but his finish skidded just inches, and I mean inches wide, of the Newcastle goal. Nketiah, as I mentioned, then finally broke free of the clutches with 3 minutes to go, but his low finish with his weaker left foot was saved smartly from the angle by Nick Pope. Newcastle had to repel one last attack in injury time when Granit Xhaka's cross from the left hit the outstretched arm of Murphy, who knew very little of it. There were furious appeals, of course, as I mentioned, from the Arsenal players, but well, the officials waved it away. And well, a frustrating match really in the end. Chances few and far between. we surely need to strengthen in January to give some sort of backup to the likes of Eddie Nketiah, Gabriel Martinelli and Bukayo Saka. Of course, Rhys Nelson and Emile Smith-Rowe are both out injured. I wonder, will Arteta turn to Fabio Vieira as well in, well, perhaps a wing role as backup? But we need to strengthen, that's for sure. It finished on Tuesday night at the Emirates. Arsenal 0, Newcastle United 0.
It's time to enter the gunroom for a natter.
Hi, welcome to the gunroom. Hey, look, it's not just the two musketeers anymore, it's three. We're joined with Lauren. How are you, Lauren?
I'm good, thank you. Lovely to be back. Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year to you as well. Did you get a bit blotto? Did you get wasted?
No, I was unfortunately struck down with illness. So I couldn't even enjoy myself. I had a few Nurofen, popped a few Nurofen instead of champagne bottles this New Year, but it's fine. All good now.
Oh, on the mend. Paul, how are you? I didn't ask, really, should I? You know, being a toffee fan.
No, you shouldn't, Tom. Yeah, quite depressed football-wise. If you're an Arsenal fan disappointed with the Newcastle game, we'll just pop places with you straight away.
Well, I think what we ought to do, really, is do you take Visa, Paul, for that result against City? I mean, we'll slip you a few quid. That's no problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, at one stage after City scored, I think Everton were 40-1 against guessing a draw. So I really wish I put some money on that one.
What a gun room we have for you tonight. We're going to look back at the games against Brighton. It's a bogey team, isn't it, for the last couple of seasons? And also the match against a resurgent Newcastle, a determined Newcastle. It's caused all sorts of hullabaloo on social media, but we'll talk about that. We'll grab an update from Lauren on the WSL. We're currently sitting second, and I think we've got a game in hand, which will bring us level if we win that. So, but we'll talk about that in a bit. First up, we must pay tribute to the one and only Pele. It was kind of mixed reactions, really, because you felt it was going to be a somber occasion, but it actually wasn't. It was a quite joyous occasion, a celebration of his life. Paul, we are old enough to remember the great man, and let's reminisce about him for a little spell. He made, I think of icons, I think of two sporting icons come to mind. One is Muhammad Ali, and the other one is Pele. I mean, it's a face well known, and whether you actually saw him play or not is irrelevant.
Yeah, well, I was actually fortunate enough to see Pele play at Goodison Park in the World Cup in 1966. I saw him in the game for Brazil against Bulgaria, and I saw him in the game for Brazil against Portugal. I was a 10-year-old at the time, and my dad had got me World Cup tickets, for which I'm still eternally grateful to this day. And I've also had the pleasure of seeing Pele score a goal from a free kick in the Glastonbury end. And for anyone of kind of our generation, the baby boomer generation, that then Pele is an absolute icon. He was the first kind of global football superstar before football was a global game. And the skill, the virtuosity, the brio, the improvisation that he brought to football was just incredible. And you know, for a guy, if you look at for 12 years from the World Cup in 1958, to the World Cup in 1970, you look at those two performances as a raw 18-year-old flicking the ball over Swedish defender's head in the final and scoring a goal for his country in the World Cup final. The King of Sweden stayed behind at the end of the game, running onto the pitch to shake his hand personally. He was so knocked out by the performance. And then he goes to 1970 in Mexico, where he was almost not going to be in the squad. He was called up at the last minute. And it, once again, you know, people, you know, he always complains.
It's almost
people,
unthinkable, isn't it? A World Cup without Pele.
It is, yeah. And he often references the fact that people refer to the Golden Banks there, quite rightly so. But, you know, you kind of forget the goals he scored. I mean, most people seem to forget he actually scored the first goal in that World Cup final with a header to put Brazil ahead. And his pass in that move for that fourth Brazil goal, where he just rolls it into the path of Carlos Alberto, and then he smashes the ball into the net for one of the finest goals I've seen in the World Cup final ever, which is simply superb. And then after that, to move on when he'd retired from football at the age of 35, and then to be approached by Henry Kissinger, of all people, to join the New York Cosmos to try and, you know, give the new fledging NASL soccer league in the States a major boost and a major lift, which he did for 2 years, which is fantastic. So, yeah, supreme sportsman, fantastic footballer. And, you know, you can have debates all day long about who's the best footballer. I think a lot of it depends on what your age is, who you've grown up watching. But I just think Pele, to me, he set the bar for, you know, what everyone else should aspire to. At the end of the day, you know, if it's a case of it shows you medals, he's got three World Cup medals, No one can come close to that.
Yeah, I mean, it was 58-62 in 1970. I mean, as a kid growing up, I mean, everyone wanted to, in the school playground, everyone wanted to be the number 10. Everyone wanted that yellow shirt. And it became a symbol. That Brazil shirt became a symbol of football purity and football at its best. I mean, that's what Pelé bought. He kind of made an international brand out of Brazil, because people think of Brazil now as the all football team and all that sort of thing, but there was a time when they weren't even in the rankings, was there? They weren't well sort of regarded at all for their football.
I mean, it's, you know, he made a massive impression, certainly when he arrived at Goodison in 66. He was the player that everybody wanted to see, and it wasn't just me as a kid who wanted to see him. My father's generation were desperate to see Pelé, because at that time as well, you know, it's not like today where you could see Brazil week in, week out on TV. There was such scant coverage on TV. What coverage there was in grainy black and white. And so, for most people, it's the first chance to see this guy in the flesh there at your home stadium. And, you look back at the '66 World Cup when he was, you know, the treatments he was given by European defenders to this day still appalls me. The lack of protection he was given by referees still appalls me as well.
Well, this is an age where you could get knocked around, wouldn't it? It was a bit more physical game. Now you've only got to sort of blink at someone and it's a yellow card. We get to that as well, by the way, Potters. We're not going to get that referee.
And even in the '66 World Cup, you know, you see some of the tackles he has to put up with, and then he gets up and shakes the hand of the person who's tackled him. None of this rolling down, you know, and screaming for a yellow card. He just gets up and gets on with it, and, you know, no trying to get an opponent sent off or anything like that. So, yeah, I mean, I think just on and off the pitch, he's the perfect role model. I think, as you outlined there as well, Tom, in terms of, you know, turning Brazil into a football power, he was the one who gave them that status. And when you think as well, you know, Brazil lost the 1950 World Cup at home to Uruguay, a result that just devastated the nation. And, you know, without Pelé starting them back on the road to recovery by helping to win that World Cup in Sweden, and even in 1958 in Sweden, apparently, you may well have heard the story, the Brazilian team were doing some extra psychometric testings to make sure they were more prepared for a European final. And they gave all the players intelligence tests, and apparently Pelé failed his intelligence test, and they're on the verge of not putting them in the squad. And it later emerged that the intelligence test they'd given them was for bus drivers in Sao Paulo. So what reference that had for football, I've absolutely no idea. But both him and Garrincha failed the intelligence test. And when they got to the final group stage that Brazil needed to win, and Pelé hadn't played a single game by that stage, the players almost, you know, stays in mutiny to manager saying, "We've got to play Pelé in this game. You know, he's the best player." And he's gone, "Why? We don't care if he's young. Why isn't he playing?" And of course, he came on, scored. They beat Wales in the quarterfinal. In the World Cup semi-final, he was 17 years of age to play in France. France got the World Cup's top scorer ever, Juice Fontaine, in the team, who scored 13 goals that competition. Brazil beat them 5-2. 17-year-old Pelé gets a hat-trick. Youngest player scored a World Cup final at the time. So, yeah, I mean, his record just speaks for itself, Tom.
Well, we are going to talk about Arsenal in a minute, Podders, but it's such a momentous occasion that we've got to celebrate it. I think there's a bit of discrepancy on his goals. One version is 1,283, and the other is 757 goals in 812 matches. But the thing is, when you're looking at centre-forwards now, he was the perfect factory-made centre-forward, wasn't he? He was fast, he was strong, he was physical, he laid off a good pass, he had good weight on the ball. There's so many things. Now we're talking about Haaland, but he wouldn't even be fit to lace Pelé's boots, because Pelé was such an all-round striker, an incredible striker. And listen, if you haven't seen some of the grainy footage or whatever, you have to go onto YouTube. You must look this guy up. And all the things I will say is all the tricks that Cruyff did, you know, when he kind of sort of backheeled it round and flicked it and all that sort of stuff. Ronaldo, Messi, Maradona, Best to a degree as well. Pelé did it all first. Pelé was the originator. He was the original footballer. And the thing is now, because he's not played football for so long, he's still well known around the globe. And that's why it's had such a monumental impact people who have seen him and people who even haven't. They've heard of him, but not seen him. He was one of my first sort of football heroes as well, has to be said. Jumpers for goalposts and all that sort of thing. And everyone wanted to be Pelé. But we should give a mention because he was in a superb team, wasn't he? The Jorginho, Gerson, Tostão, Rivelino. It was probably, I would say, up to now, the best international side I have ever seen. Fluency of football. They played it with a smile. And that's what you wanted. That's what Brazil was. And that's what fundamentally Pelé was as well. So we wish everyone in Brazil all the best. I'm sure they're out partying and celebrating because that's what he deserves. I'm having a Budweiser. I don't know what they're having, but I'm having a Budweiser. No red wine for you, Lauren, is it? You're on antibiotics or something?
Yeah. Yeah. Not doing dry Jan quite, but, you know, just the first few days, but I'll be back on it next week.
Paul's on a cup of tea. So I've got tea and beer. Don't judge me. Let's look back at the Brighton game. Let's try and have a squint at the team sheet. We were playing 4-3-3. It was Aaron Ramsdale, Zinchenko, Gabriel, William Saliba, Ben White, Granit Xhaka, Thomas Partey, Martin Odegaard. We'll have lots to say about Martin Odegaard. Gabriel Martinelli, Eddie Nketiah, Bukayo Saka. Lauren, we'll come to you first. What did you make of the performance? I mean, as I said, they've been our bogey team for quite some time, haven't they? And we didn't know what we'd get.
Absolutely. I think, you know, probably is worth mentioning as well, being in Brighton are kind of in a bit of a transition at the moment as well, having lost their manager.
Not a transition. Everyone's in a transition.
You know what I mean. You know what I mean. It is a bit of a change in period for them. So I think it was a good time for us to face them. You know what I mean? Overall, I mean, you can't really complain about a performance like that. I think, if anything, the scoreline was, you know, it was it flattered them more than it flattered us. I think overall we looked very dominant and, you know, it was a great way to end the year.
Absolutely. Paul, did you see that game?
Yeah, I did, yeah. From my perspective, it was absolute attacking masterclass from Arsenal all the way through. Some of the passing, I mean, particularly the pass from Odegaard that set Martinelli off for his goal was absolutely superb to watch. And I just, you know, from the first minute, you know, we talked before on this pod about Arsenal going at teams from the start of matches. And I think once again, you saw that in evidence against Brighton, that Brighton had that time to settle. And within the first minute, Arsenal won it up. And Saka takes the chance really, really well. And once again, coming out the start of the second half, scoring within 2 minutes of the restart to kind of, you know, deaden any chance of Brighton coming back into the game. It's a good goal for Nketiah to make it 3-0. I mean, okay, you might say to tap him, but you've got to be there to hit the tap and hope. It's not that
easy.
Goal
as well, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And that's, you know, you probably say you might not have to flamboyant to Jesus, but when Jesus isn't there, you need someone to put the ball in the nest. Mm-hmm. I thought that's what he did really well. I know, Tom, you'd want to talk about the second goal in detail, so I'll leave you to do that. I won't take your glory away there.
Well, but yeah, absolutely. I am an Odegaard disciple. I love the boy. And I'm getting myself in all sorts of hot water. We'll discuss a little bit about the negativity that he's actually pulling in. It's unbelievable, honestly. Yeah, 34 million.
My only slight concern would be towards the end of the game. I think Arsenal should have had the game dead, barely killed off. And absolutely. Brighton were allowed their way back into the game. And I think that says something for Brighton's resilience as well, because, you know, as I experienced last night, you go fall down at home and the team collapses. They didn't. They kept playing. They kept thought they could get back in the game. And, you know, you at one stage, that offside disallowed goal when it was 4-2, that could have made for quite an interesting finale to the match. So a few little defensive concerns, but in the end, it didn't matter. And I just think at the end of that game, particularly with Everton having taken 2 points off Man City, it's really set Arsenal up to be in a really healthy position to face 2023 in a really, you know, holding all the cards in terms of being able to hang on to the lead and, you know, potentially take it through to the end of the season.
Well, I like the way you said it was interesting. I would have turned it squeaky bum time.
For sure.
let's run through it all. Bask in the glory. Saka, as you say, got on the end of it was kind of a deflected cross, wasn't it? It fell into his lap, basically, but he still had to take that touch and finish it off. Odegaard, we are not worthy. Yeah. Well, he was on point, 39 minutes gone. Almost Ozil-esque, wasn't it? That, do you remember when he hit the ball into the turf and mm-hmm. everyone was amazed. I mean, I used to do that every week, but not on purpose. So that went into the roof of the net. And as you say, Nketiah managed to shuffle the ball over the line. Great instincts. And then Brighton got the nerves jangling. Very much so. It was something like a 12-minute spell, wasn't it? Mitoma, is that his name? Mm. He looks like a real find. He scored the second, which was deemed offside. And we all breathed a sigh of relief. But in between, we had that fabulous, fabulous pinpoint Odegaard pass. Took one look up. Saw Martinelli on the boosters and just put the ball through. At one stage, I didn't think Martinelli connected that well with it, but it still found its way into the net. So it was superb. We'll take it in if it goes off an elbow, obviously. A bit of a wobble conceding those two goals, and the third was ruled out offside. But yet again, we've got to talk about second match on the trot. It was West Ham and then Brighton. Odegaard just shone, yeah. Sparkled. What do you make, the pair of you, let's go with Lauren first, of the criticism that he doesn't turn up for the big matches? Now, I had this discussion with Rich on Facebook this morning. Hello, Rich. And he said, basically, like, he can do it to the smaller teams, but against Newcastle, he was actually wiped out. Lauren, how do you feel about that statement?
Yeah, I don't think it's very fair. I think he can do it when he has a bit of space. You know, it doesn't matter what team, if it's big team, small team, if teams are... You know, if he has a bit of space, a bit of time, I think, you know, but again, you just need to watch him, like actually watch a game of just Odegaard and you'll see how much he does. He's one of those players, I think, who's going to get a lot of criticism because he's maybe not the most, let's say, visible, if you know what I mean. Like he'll do a lot kind of off the ball or prior to the goal going in, let's say, that probably isn't picked up by people if they're casually watching it. He is an exceptional player. He really is amazing. It was two man of the match performances on the trot. It was, you know, I think he really was the difference in the Brighton game. His goal, I thought people were a bit harsh on saying that it wasn't a good goal, that he scuffed it a bit. I thought it was, you know, I think they said that to him in the post-match interview. Exactly, they all count. I think they said that to him in the post-match interview and he kind of defended himself saying, you know, I thought it was a good goal. The criticism, yeah, I think it's a bit unfair. I think time will tell a bit as the season goes on as well. We have a lot of, you know, the big game for us this season, really, let's be honest, is how players perform against City. I think if you consider last season, obviously now's the time to reflect on that. We think back to our New Year's game last year against City. That first 20 minutes or so, we were on fire. If we can bring that tempo this season and maintain it and actually keep our heads like this game and win it, I think that's going to, not just for Odegaard, but for a lot of other players as well, stand to them, and people will start to see that they do show up in big games and that, you know, it's not just a team of young players who, you know, maybe are slightly overrated or can't do it against the big teams. But I think it's unfair, and I think he's done it enough times now for that to be ruled as bullshit, to be honest, you know.
Absolutely. Can smell it. The thing is, right, okay, I'm going back a few years. Bergkamp, Omri, Vieira, sometimes one of them didn't show up. You know, you have good games, you have bad games. And it depends, Paul, doesn't it, on the approach of, we'll get to Newcastle, but we'll talk about Newcastle briefly. The way that you set your team up, you're not going to roll over because, like, Arsenal are top of the league, are you? You're going to put your back into it. You're going to do your homework. The best way to stop Arsenal is to limit the space. And people like Odegaard, Saka and Martinelli, you don't want the ball going to. And if you noticed as well, there was a line of four. It was about a 15-foot space and a line of four or five again behind. So it was really tight. But that's what you do, Paul, isn't it? You try to Newcastle are no mugs, neither are Brighton. You try to suck all the oxygen out of the side because you're going to nullify their threat.
Yeah, mate, exactly, Tom. I mean, I'm sure Eddie Howe before the game had used his technical staff to get all the details and data on Odegaard. And I think they quickly worked out that you can't give this guy time or space on the ball because he's going to destroy with his passing. You can't leave him unmarked at the edge of the box because he's going to hit you with a volley to score the goal. And players can't have a 10-on-10 performance every week. It's just simply impossible to do that. There are going to be games when performance levels are going to dip. Then the key thing is then that other players step up to the plate who've been averaging an 8 to 10 or a 7 on 10 and take on the role. I'm sure, in some ways, I think you learn more from when one of your star players has been restricted slightly, how you then plan to counteract that, particularly when the next league game is the North London Derby. I'm sure Conte's seen that and you've got a few ideas in mind of how to deal with Odegaard based on that. But I think, you know, class will tell. Odegaard is a class player. One slightly below average performance by his exceptionally high standards doesn't mean you come out with sweeping statements like he only turns up against the not-so-called bigger teams. And I've kind of made the point before on this podcast that you get the same number of points for beating a small team as you do for beating a big team. And come the end of the season, it's kind of wins at Southampton, it's wins at West Ham, it's wins at Brentford, it's wins at Crystal Palace that to some extent are more important than beating teams in the top six. Because, you know, the title chance can stumble at any stage for a run of bad results. So, I saw some of the negativity you were dealing with on Facebook there, Tom, today.
In terms of
some of the remarks directed about Odegaard's performance, you know. And I mean, don't forget that this is like, you know, the teams have played about three or four games now in intensely short space of time as well. So, yeah, okay, maybe it wasn't his top performance, but the guy is a really, really talented footballer. And you know, would you say, you know, would he walk into any other team in the top six of the Premier League? Absolutely.
Yeah. It's kind of funny, isn't it? Because, you know, Ozil used to disappear in matches. Not disappear, that became a phrase, but he didn't get the room to operate. People like Ozil, Santi Cazorla, these type of players, they all need the space to operate. And sometimes he does it without any space. I mean, he'll nutmeg two players on the on the touchline, not a problem. So he works incredibly well in very small space. Right, let's do the stat. Brighton, 9 shots, Arsenal 14. 5 shots on target for them, 7 for us. 66% possession for them, 32% for us. 597 passes for them. 288. Yeah, I did read that correctly for us. 88% pass accuracy for them and 72% for us. There were 7 fouls for them and 11 for us. And we get to the yellow cards. But there were 6 yellow cards, 3 either side in that match. So let's just clear up the player of the match. Lauren, we'll go with you first. Player of the match.
I mean, does it need repeating? It has to be Martin Odegaard. It really has to be Martin Odegaard. I've been very impressed with Nketiah in the past 3 games since he's started in the Premier League. I think he's also really, really stepped up to the mark. And he's doing what Jesus wasn't doing, which is getting goals as well, you know, which is really nice to see. It's a great option to have, on the bench. I'm not sure how long Jesus is going to be out for now, but, you know, it's positive signs that I think we're all a bit worried about. So maybe just give him a little mention as well. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Odegaard does his stuff is very sort of reliant on the likes of, let's give him mention, Partey and Xhaka, because they 100%. Allow him that freedom to go forward. Anyway, Paul, you're man of the match. Are you going to swap it about a bit?
Yeah, but I won't go for the obvious choice because you'd love to cover that in some detail. I think there's a case for saying Martinelli could be up there because directly or indirectly, he had a role in 3 of the goals, didn't he? There was a scuff shot there to the first goal. He'd scored the 4th goal and it was his run and shot of goal that then catches their goal as well. So I think in terms of contribution towards the final score, I think you make a strong case for Martinelli and his pace as well really caused Brighton problems all the way through the game.
Good shout.
He's been, yeah, that is a very good shout. He's been exceptional this season. Suddenly he's coming into his own. He could be frightening in a few seasons' time, couldn't he? I mean, he's already hitting the gears. Obviously, Martin Odegaard for me. No secret, is it? That's the fact here. Martin Odegaard's last 3 games, 2 goals against Wolves, 2 assists against West Ham, a goal and an assist against Brighton. 15 games so far this season, 7 goals, 5 assists. And obviously, we're top of the Premier League. And just a little reminder, 34 million for that guy. Unbelievable. And we're going to be talking about players coming into various clubs and they're not going to be at 34 million price tag. That's for sure. Lauren, let's go to you. Bring us up to speed with the WSL. Yes. Where are we with injuries? Because they're just falling over, aren't they? Everything that can break 100%. And fall off. How are we doing?
Absolutely. So yeah, I think the last time we spoke, I can't remember. I was thinking back. I think it was just before the Aston Villa game, wasn't it? So that was our last game before the winter break. So we're currently in the winter break. We're back then, I think, the 15th of January. So about a month or so. It always happens in the WSL. There's always a winter break. So Arsenal won that 4-1 away from home. Pretty standard game. We did go 1-0 down fairly early on, but then shifted back into, that was, the goal was conceded in sixth minute, and then shifted back into gear and ended up winning 4-1. Pretty routine. As you mentioned, I think at the beginning of this podcast, Tom, we are currently in second place, just behind Chelsea, who are our next opponents that we're facing in the WSL.
Spicy.
On the 15th. Ooh, I'm sure we'll get onto that now soon. But yeah, exactly. So then after that, we had two Champions League games. So the group stages are now finished. The big news, as you mentioned, injuries. We now have Viviana Miedema sidelined for an extended period with, just like Beth Mead, a ruptured ACL. Not the best news. That came in our 1-0 loss to Lyon in the Champions League. It was a pretty tight match, but I think her injury obviously had a massive impact. I mean, she went off the pitch on a stretcher crying, and the whole team just looked completely deflated. I think everyone knew what was coming based on the reaction of not just her, but the team, the staff. It was a tough one to take. Nevertheless, we bounced back with a 9-1 win over Zurich the following week, which saw a Manham hat-trick. And some good news on the injury front, Kim Little was back and she scored a penalty. So, I mean, in terms of injuries, we're getting there. Some of the short-term injuries. So we have obviously our centre-back pairing are back. That's a bit of a tongue twister.
See, it's not just me, is it?
So they're back. We have Kim Little coming back, which is great. But as I mentioned, Miedema and Beth Mead both out with ACL ruptures. It's going to be until the end of the season. Whether they are back in time for the World Cup this summer is looking very unlikely, which is tough for both of them, obviously, especially Beth Mead, having had such a great tournament with England last summer, which I don't think I need to repeat. We all know what happened there.
This could so really cost us, though. These pile of injuries, they're stacking up, and it's all two key players, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, you think
defense pairing, strikers.
Yeah, you think, you know, Mead, that's one thing, but Mead and Miedema, that is a different kettle of fish. We're really in, you know, luckily now we have the transfer window open, so fingers crossed something happens there, but not great on the injury front. We'll have to wait and see.
It's not actually going to be easy in January for anyone, is it?
No.
Men or women to get people in. So Beth Mead was BBC Sports Personality of the Year.
Yeah.
Well deserved as well. That's a game changer, isn't it? That is a 100% game changer for the women's game.
Yeah, 100%. And I think if you watch the ceremony, it was very much about the Lionesses. And, you know, obviously Serena Wiegmann got the coach of the season as well. It was so deserved from everyone. Beth Mead, she's won almost every individual prize on the back of her Euros performance, except for that Ballon d'Or, which she missed out by just one vote. You know, that would
be going on there.
Yeah, it would have been great again, but obviously she missed out to Alexia Putellas, who was out with another ACL injury. It's a bit of a common theme now in the women's game. All the top, I think 20% of the top players are out with ACL, so that's another thing there. But yeah, no, it was definitely a well-needed morale boost, should we say, after her pretty tough injury. So yeah, and another thing to mention as well is that a list of the Lionesses did receive honours in the King's honorary list. I'm not sure what it is. Beth Mead's going to be an MBE, and Williamson has been awarded an OBE as well. So that's some good news.
Oh, I think I saw Leah Williamson on Graham Norton.
Yes.
She's scrubbed up well,
isn't
she?
Doesn't she? Yeah, she's very glam.
I didn't recognize her for a second. let's just give Beth Mead a due. She beat the England Test cricket captain, Ben Stokes. I mean, you know, massive accolade there. Mm-hmm. So it's Chelsea up next on the 15th. It's a game that has huge significance. More than 35,000 tickets have already been sold. That's going to be a massive old affair. And there's not much between them. It's just like a bus ticket between them, isn't it? So we're on the same track as we were last year, and it's who blinks first.
Exactly. It's a game we've seen played out many, or it's the rivalry we've seen played out many times. You know, Chelsea have always been either the team right on our heels or the team that we're trying to play catch up with. It's in the Emirates, as you mentioned, 35,000 tickets sold, which is very impressive. It's going to be tough off the back of our last Emirates performance against United, which was very deflated. You know, I think we lost that 3-2 in the end, but there was just no real bite, no fight. It was our first loss in the Emirates. So it's going to be, you know, interesting to see how we come back from that, given our injury situation. But yeah, Chelsea does have the potential to have a slightly different feel, a bit more competitive, a bit more bite to it, you know. So hopefully that, and after the winter break as well. Obviously, it's tough to come back, but hopefully everyone's well rested and ready to go, because this could be the decider, you know.
Everything crossed. Transfer wise, let's do a bit of ducking and diving there. Canada's goalkeeper, Sabrina D'Angelo, apparently could be joining us on a free. Have you heard anything about that? What's the vibe?
I have, yeah. I'm very active in this transfer, or lots of links, shall we say. Maybe not so active so much, but we have also been linked with Catherine Kuhl, who has been described as the best young talent in Scandinavia at the moment. She's a midfielder. So as you mentioned, we have goalkeepers being linked to us, midfielders, but nothing really in terms of a striker yet, which I would say is probably the most important position that we need to be filling with Mead and Miedema out. It's early yet. We'll see what comes. But
God, we all need a striker, don't we?
Yes. You know what? If that keeper can play, if that keeper has a good foot on her, we'll put her up there. I don't care at this point, you know.
Also a Brazilian pairing as well. Rafael and Dabina. Did I get that right?
Sounds good, yeah.
What do we know about them?
Not that much. They are,
I like to hear,
as you mentioned,
that.
Brazilian. Yeah. to be honest, so Brazilian forward Davina, she's a forward. There you go. But in terms of proper or likelihood, I haven't heard much. But names are heavily being linked with us, so we'll have to wait and see, I suppose.
Well,
but
men's team has got about 34 people coming to the club. So
we just need one. We just need one.
Right, let's move on to Newcastle then. We've wetted our whistle for the WSL. And I say it's the 15th. It's against Chelsea. It's a real banger. Support the girls. That's all I can say.
Yeah. It's actually the same day as the North London Derby, I was going to say. It's going to be a wild afternoon. It's going to be a long one, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that will be a tasty podcast when we get round to it.
Oh, God.
So, Newcastle next. I don't know how to feel about that game, or I didn't until this morning. Look. People, podders, we didn't lose, we drew, we're 8 points clear at the top of the Premier League. What's the problem? Now, Paul was mentioning my Facebook post, and I was quite piffy, I was quite angry. Please stop acting like we've lost the Premier League. It was a rough night against a well-drilled team, and they weren't about to roll over because we're top of the league. They were disappointing, to be fair. And it shows that in terms of genuine football, Newcastle are not at the races. Negative and poor, but it did the job. And at least they will do the same to the other teams in the division. Top of the league, 8 points clear, as I said. Hardly a disaster. I think that's the way to look at it. It was a strange old game. Let's just have a look at the lineup. Aaron Ramsdale, Ben White, William Saliba, Gabriel, it's looking the same old team, isn't it? Zinchenko, Martin the God, Odegaard, Thomas Partey, Granit Xhaka, Bukayo Saka, Eddie Nketiah, and Gabriel Martinelli. Paul, let's bring some sanity, some unbiased sanity from Merseyside. What did you make of the game?
Well, I think I was firmly of the perspective that it was actually a point gained. I think it's so important when you're playing kind of other teams in the top four or five not to lose against them, but not to, you know, to try and prevent them getting 3 points if they cast the gap up as well. I think it's inevitable during the course of the season. You're going to drop the odd point at home. I mean, look at Man City. They dropped 5 points their last home games against us and against Brentford. So, you know, this idea that you just turn up at home and expect to win is not going to happen. I think as well, you know, Newcastle Canes do a job on Arsenal. They doubled up on Martinelli, they doubled up on Saka, they restricted Odegaard, they're determined to just come out with the points. You look at their defensive record this season, they conceded 11 goals. Think about 4 or 5 goals, that's better than anybody else in the Premier League. They've lost one game all season, and even that they were cheesed out of Anfield, which is an experience most teams get there from time to time. And they're a really, really strong defensive team. They're really, really hard to break down. The tackle is very astute. And that was always going to be a really tough game, coming on the back of the Arsenal game, of the Brighton game 3 or 4 days ago as well. So I couldn't believe some of the negativity you happened to deal with on Facebook. I was really of the view that, you know, you didn't lose, you didn't concede a goal, no one got sent off. Okay, you know, you didn't get the 3 points, but you won.
Oh, that was more luck than judgment with that ref, wasn't it?
It was.
I thought, bloody hell, he's a magician. He's acting out fast. Let's get out of fashion. Pick a yellow.
Yeah, well, I think Andrew Madley refereed the Man City Everton game a few days beforehand as well. So he's a referee who likes that the game flow. I think that's quite a generous way of describing his kind of handling of matches. But overall, I would be reasonably positive with that, because it keeps the 8-point gap at the top. And as you know, the number of games winds down, that gap becomes more and more significant. And I was kind of reading somewhere earlier on today that if, as I see my math serves me right here, if you work on the basis that 90 points is more or less going to put you in with a really, really good chance of lifting the Premier League title, it has done on many seasons, then if Arsenal can get 46 points out of the remaining 63, they're going to be really, really, you know, difficult to take the title away from. And that's assuming, of course, that other teams playing catch-up win all their games in the meantime. So, you know, Arsenal are still in the strongest position. Okay, I can look, you know, maybe, I suppose it's quite unusual to be here saying, have Arsenal fans been spoiled by success this season? Has to be this idea that, you know, we just have to turn up to get the 3 points, because there are certain games we have to battle to get something out of. There are certain games where you can't have the flowing football, we can't have the sumptuous skills. There are certain games you have to dig in and try and get something from the game. And that, you know, from that perspective, for Arsenal, obviously the win would have been far more preferable, but they didn't lose, they didn't concede the goal, they got the point, and they're still 8 points clear at the top. I don't really see any pessimism about that.
Lauren, coming into that game, what was your feeling? Did you? I said on a podcast over and over with Rich that the smart money was on a draw, because they're two counter-attacking teams, blistering pace, two fairly solid defences as well. So it kind of negated what was going on, didn't it?
Absolutely, and I think I was a bit nervous going into this one. I think given Newcastle's form, you know, their run that they've been on, our run that we've been on, it just kind of felt like it was going to be a clash of the Titans. And I was expecting, not that I was expecting anything less than a draw at least, but a draw was kind of my realistic outlook. And I thought that would be a good result, something that we could celebrate. I probably would have preferred to have scored a goal at least. But, you know, they were so good defensively. And I think it's probably the first time this season in the league where I think an opposition manager has been able to outplay or out-tactic Arteta. You know, we've obviously dropped points against Southampton, but I think we were just a bit sloppy that afternoon. It just wasn't really working for us. The United game where we dropped points, that was, you know, we were the better team in that game. Look, do you know what, Tom? There's only three occasions I can mention the three, okay? Come on, it's not that bad. Some positivity here, okay? But in terms of a manager's approach to the game, I think Eddie Howe needs a lot of credit. It's the first time I've really seen, you know, Arsenal being stopped this season, because at times they've looked unstoppable. So there's that as well. I think we should be happy with the draw. We're still 8 points clear. Obviously, we have a tough run coming up. So do City. You know, they have Chelsea on Thursday. So, yeah. I mean, obviously, Chelsea aren't having the best of time this season. But, you know, you never know. It seems like a game that they could get something out of and they could do us a favour. So, yeah, look, no need to panic. No need to panic, as you've all mentioned. It's completely fine. It was more of a frustrating evening than a disappointing one.
The game I expected, because it was built up. And I think amongst the fans as well, the expectations were huge.
Yeah.
We're going to rattle in. I
100%.
Think Neil on Over and Over said it was going to be 6-3. He's regretting that now. I spoke to him this morning. He went, yeah, you got it bang on. It was a draw. But yeah, I mean, the expectations, I personally expected a really open game. And shouldn't have, even though I predicted a draw. But I expected a better game. As you say, it's tactics. He wasn't going to come down to North London and just sort of let us roll over him. So Eddie Howe as you say, deserves a lot of credit for that. Paul, Newcastle managed to get control of that game after a burst of about 10, 15 minutes where we were all over them like a cheap suit from Burton's. We were all over that's that sponsorship, God, isn't it? We're all over them like a cheap suit. And they managed to kind of slow the game down and cut the space down. As I say, they had that line of four and five constantly interchanging, cutting down the triangles that we normally form. It was good how we worked that out, wasn't it? I mean, it's no shame to have a draw out of it. And we could have actually lost 1-0 because Joel Linton had a bit of a sitter.
Yeah, it was a good opportunity up in the head for Joe Linton as well. It was quite interesting before the pod this evening. I went on the Newcastle United site to see what their highlights of the game was like, and their perspective on it was obviously completely different from what the Arsenal perspective would be. And in the highlights package, I think they showed one of the Arsenal opportunities and about five or six of Newcastle. I use opportunities in inverted commas as well. So it was fascinating to see their perspective. But at the end of the game, when they put the camera onto Eddie Howe, you could see from the Newcastle coaching staff's reactions at the final whistle, they felt job done. We've come here to get a point. We've got a point. We're delighted with that. And you know, there was no over the top celebration. They knew what they'd set out to contain Arsenal. No, apart from one or two chances, they more or less did that throughout the game. And I think the one thing that will cost Newcastle this season, I don't think they've got enough of a threat up front. I don't think they're going to score enough goals to really make sure that they're in the top three or four towards the end of the season. But January window, that situation could well change for them. They've got is Isaac to come back from injury as well, the guy they bought from Real Sociedad in the summer. So they might be more of a threat attacking wise at the end of this month, possibly. But sometimes you have to credit the opposition for doing the homework, for getting mm-hmm. the tactics right and stopping your team play. And then the thing is now, once you're back at the training ground, because I'm sure all the teams will be looking and thinking, right, there might be a chance here we could employ the same tactics. Having the backup plans to change the approach maybe slightly, maybe give Odegaard more support in the middle of the park to get more space for them, use the wings to try and create more space on the wings, overload on one side maybe, and just see how that works out. But yeah, I think, as both you and Lauren have said, it's a point. It's another step towards where you want to be at the end of the season.
Yeah, it's a dirty draw. I mean, I like a dirty draw. That'll do me. Put that in the bank. Is it fair to criticise Eddie Howe, Lauren? I mean, he's from where they were last season, like us. I mean, they were nowhere to be seen, were they? And then all of a sudden, if we're talking about transitions, that's one that's massive. You can't criticise him for coming down to want that point.
I don't think so. I think you really have to stand back and admire what he's done. You know, obviously, we're talking about Newcastle, a club that has basically unlimited resources behind them now. But I don't think people expected to see such a quick improvement. And I think that all goes down to the manager. I think he's done an exceptional job. And look, they mightn't play the nicest football. They mightn't play the most attacking football. Yes, they're very defensive. But, you know, they do it well. They're well drilled. It's not the worst football I've ever seen. Last night it was, don't get me wrong. But, you know,
that's normally that more up the road, isn't it?
I wasn't even going to mention their name, but yeah, exactly. No, credit where credit's due. You have to take your hat off and say Eddie Howe's done an exceptional job. Probably my nomination for manager of the season so far. Obviously, you know, we'll see how things go at the end. But given where they were last season to now, I mean, it's incredible, really. And as I said, I thought tactically he's the first manager that has put up a team that have been able to outplay us to suppress us to a certain extent this season. So yeah, no, I think it's a bit unfair to not give him the credit he deserves.
There was one thing that really did hack me off. I'll get to it right now, Podders. I'll tell you all about it. I feel my angst. It was just a time wasting. Myself and Paul spoke about it last week. Said about all the clutching the legs and getting the physios on and all that sort of thing, and it seemed to go on forever. So out of about 15 minutes, I thought it was about 12, 15 minutes. Some think it's less. Some think it's more. We got 5 minutes added on, and I. Paul, it's appalling, isn't it? They've really got to do the old Kalina and start getting independent timekeepers, because it was a shit show.
Yeah. As you say, Tom, we talked about this at length last week, didn't we? There has to be some kind of a decision made thing at the top level that the time wasting, if you're not going to clamp down the time wasting, you've got to post on sufficient minutes to compensate for the time that's being wasted. Because more and more these days, if you're training at home 1-0 in the last 5 minutes, you know the opposition's going to fall down, roll over, make substitutions, try and wind the clock down. And it just makes the last few minutes of the game sometimes a non-event, because you just know what the tactics are going to be. And you can see that Newcastle had, that was in their mindset before the match even starts, that if they got to that stage after 90 minutes, you could just say, that's it, let's start rolling over, let's start falling down, let's slow the game down to walking pace and let's take the points. And I think they were quite pleased with that outcome. But I think from the spectator point of view, it's not the type of finale to a match that you want to see. You want to see teams going for the victory at the end of the game, rather than the clock ticking away slowly. And as we said last time, Tom, I think at some stage now, maybe football needs to look at the examples of rugby league, rugby union, take the timekeeping away from the match official and put it in the hands of an official timekeeper. And every time the ball goes out to play, every time the ball is dead, the clock stops. And then that way we might actually guess a full quota of football played in the regulation time.
Yeah, well, we spoke about, giving value for money. And that's not value for money. You're getting robbed while you're sitting in your seat watching a match. And I've got to be honest with you, it got progressively worse. It got bitty and scrappy and tension was building. And it got a bit narky. And it ruined what was, for me, it was like a 1970s, 1980s game. It was all that sort of huffing and puffing and a bit physical and all the rest of it. But we'll get to that referee in a minute. Just to finish off with Eddie Howe, 6 clean sheets in a row. Newcastle have conceded just 11 goals all season. The best record in the top flight, losing only 1 in their last 16 matches. And it was the first game Arsenal have failed to score in this league campaign. Right, let's just walk through the stats, but we'll come back to some of the disappointing stuff as well. So Arsenal 17 shots, Newcastle 8. I was a bit mystified. I only thought they had one attempt on goal.
I'm surprised we had 17. When?
Yeah, a bit misleading, isn't it? 4 shots on target for us, 1 for them. Ah, there's the one. 67% possession for us, 33 for them. 636 passes for us, 253 for them. 85% pass accuracy for us, 71% for them. That's that. Wow. That bit of paper gone. Disappointed with the service Martinelli got. I thought we missed a trick, because when the game was in play, Martinelli was getting these balls. They were short. They were behind him. They were too far wide. Yeah. It drove me crazy, because Saka was getting better balls. He's the one you want to pump that ball down to him, let him run onto it. And he didn't get the service. It really hacked me off. Lauren, what was your opinion of what else annoyed you?
Oof, great question. I suppose that was the big thing, really, was some of the passes actually to Martinelli as well. We did comment on that when I was watching it yesterday. To a certain extent, you mentioned Saka there. There was 3 on him at all times. Obviously, we had a blistering start, and it was really the game where we needed to have an early goal like we had at the Brighton game, because, you know, that's when they were kind of settling in and we were ready to go. That would have been the perfect time. And I don't think they, you know, that would have been obviously a completely different game had that have happened. But as soon as, I suppose, the threat on the right-hand side was, you know, detected in Saka, they gave him no space and it was really difficult for him to do anything. I think he could have used a bit more support there. But then obviously, you know, you risk being pulled a bit too far out of, you know, formation and leaving gaps, which was a bit annoying. I thought, you know, another annoying thing was how soon after our last match we're playing again, you could see, obviously, Ben White came off. He looked very tired prior to his substitution. He made a great tackle. And I was kind of going, you know, get up off your feet. Like, come on, you need to get this ball out of there. And I thought, you know, Saliba still has a bit of a World Cup hangover, I'm feeling. You know, it's understandable. But yeah, it just looks a little bit off the pace where he was, you know, at the start of the season. That being said, I think Gabriel has stepped up and he's...
Yeah, he has.
What a performance he had yesterday. In terms of things that annoyed me, they're probably the most, and obviously the referee, but We'll get to that, I'm sure.
Well, let's talk about the highlight of the game. For me, it was that save by Nick Pope from Eddie Nketiah. I mean, how he got to that. It was an old Pat Jennings trick, that. Get your leg out. You remember those days, don't you, Paul? Old Pat.
I do.
Big hands, grab the ball or use a shin or a bit of buttock or whatever to keep it out. It was a great save. I mean, that really did. If the Joel Linton was their one chance, then that was probably our best chance of all. And it fell to the right person. He didn't fall to someone who couldn't hit a barn door with a banjo. Arsenal will come up against these sides, won't they, Paul? Happy with the point. Surely it's Arsenal's problem to solve. I mean, I'm having a little bit of banter on Facebook with various people. It is our problem.
Yeah, I thought Lauren made a really good point before as well about the rotation of the squad as well, that maybe last night was an opportunity to maybe, rotate the team a little bit, bring something. Obviously, Newcastle planned to play against a certain starting 11. Might that be the chance maybe to change that a little bit, change the system, give them something else to think about? Because I think rotation is going to be increasingly important as the season progresses. I think injuries are going to be much, much more of a factor as well. I think you saw last night as well how much Jesus is missed in those type of games, when his ability to twist and turn in the penalty area, to maybe win a penalty, to maybe, put defenders under pressure. I mean, Nketiah, he scored and goals, we've watched him tonight too, but he doesn't quite bring the same virtuosity to bowl as what Jesus does as well. So, and I suppose the other thing as well is, if you have to find a way to win matches, don't you? So if Martinelli's not being brought into the game enough, if Saka's being closed down, well, what's the alternative? How can we get the midfield a bit further forward? How can we create some other chances? So it's all part of the ebb and flow of the game. This is it. The opposition come with this plan to contain you, right? Okay, their plans. What do we do to bypass that plan? What do we do to win the game? But I think your point about rotation one was really good, that maybe there was a case for saying in this particular game, could Arsenal have made a few changes to give a bit more zip and energy to the team. I mean, just looking last night from my experience at Goodison Park, Brighton made about four changes for the game against us. And you could see they had fast-paced players in the team who returned to make an impression.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was screaming out for subs earlier on yesterday. I think we only had the one, which was Tomiyasu coming on, and he did great coming on. But in those four positions, you're just looking for even Vieira's on the bench, and the camera pan to Arteta, and he's sitting on the bench. The 80th minute, you're thinking he's not even warming up. Like, what's going on here? It was a bit uninspired, I'd say. I don't know.
It kind of shows that we've got no backup. You've got some 100%, options, very limited. And I can't wait for ESR to come back. he's the main boy, isn't he? He's going to add a bit of zip and a bit of vigour. It was kind of, I think we said this last podcast as well, Paul. You look at that bench, you think, where are we going to get any joy? And there's not enough players or depth in there, but I'm sure that the Arsenal are going to sort it out. Now let's get to that referee. He went for card happy, didn't he? Oh my God! I mean, the thing is here: if you see an ankle tap and you go yellow, where'd you go with that? Because I mean, something massively, some sort of hack with your studs up. Is he just going to yellow it? He seemed to be all at sea. He seemed to lose control, and I'm not the only one to say it. It was a mess. I think it was seven yellows, was there? Most of them were Arsenal's.
Yeah. It was nine of them, I think, Tom. I think it was four for Arsenal, five for Newcastle.
I lost count. They even got a yellow for the guy who wasn't even on the pitch.
Yeah, the cells, wasn't it? Yeah, that's right.
It was an alarming performance. And surely the FA are going to look at that and sort of say, come on, we'll send you back to school, because... it was just clueless and desperate, a bit like Arteta was getting. As we said, only 5 minutes added on as well. That was a bit of a pain. Had an interesting quote. It was on social media. Not a supporter of either team. So as a neutral, the time wasting is infuriating. That's going back to our point. And his name's Dan Christmas. And a happy new year. I hate to say these words, but the ref needs to follow the FIFA directive, adding the necessary minutes on, and that would please neutrals, never mind Arsenal. And I think that just reinforces what we said. Arsenal were exposed, as I say, to their lack of depth. Let's talk about decisions that Arteta, oh, he was a man possessed, wasn't he? Up and down. A bit of bickering with Eddie Howe. It was great to see. I love all that. But let's have a look at some of those. Arteta expressed his anger on the touchline after Arsenal were denied a penalty in stoppage time. The ball struck the arm of a Newcastle defender. I think it was Jacob Murphy in the box. What did you think about that, Lauren? Did you think it was a pen? I couldn't see. The angles were too tight. The camera never seemed to give us a proper peripheral vision type thing.
Yeah, from what I've seen, I think I saw a different angle view on, I think it was Twitter today, and it looked like a pen. And you could, and my initial reaction was, you know, obviously all the players straight to the ref, Arteta straight to the fourth official. And obviously Eddie Howe got a bit annoyed by that, but there was two earlier pen shouts that we didn't get either, and no one reacted. So, you know, we didn't get it because, or it's, you know, it wasn't awarded because of an overreaction. You know, exactly, it's Arsenal, that's why. It was infuriating, it was really, really annoying. There was definitely three shouts that could have been looked at. There was the shirt pull on Gabriel for a free kick. Eddie Nketiah was thrown to the ground as well at some point, literally picked up and thrown out of the way. And then the handball. And to me, the handball probably was the best shout that, you know, for a penalty. But three shouts that weren't even looked at by VAR. It was an absolutely atrocious performance by the refs. Really ruined the game. Like you said, he just, within, I think it was around the 38 minute mark, he just seemed to lose his head. Cards were flying. And I think from that point, the game was damned in the sense that, you know, it just kind of spiraled from there, and it lost all the flow it had. And it just became a very tense watch. And at one point I thought Granit Xhaka was going to be sent off, and I was thinking, oh no, here we go. Downward spiral. Season over. We've been here
before.
Come if
the hour, come if the man.
Who else, you know?
Go straight for the red.
Exactly. But no, shocking. It was really infuriating.
The main one for me was the Gabriel one where it was upended. You saw that one. Did you think that was an absolute pen? I thought it was
100%. 100%. We've seen them given.
Yeah. Is that the moment where Dan Burns was pulling his shirt?
That's right. Yeah. Gave him a midriff cuddle, didn't he? And threw him on the floor.
I thought that there was a stronger case for that being a pen than the handball against Murphy towards the end. It's one of those things that kind of frustrates me about referees, because there's no consistency about that type of challenge in the penalty. Some would give a penalty for that, others won't. And you're never quite sure from one week to the next whether pulling someone's shirt off the bat in the penalty is going to get you a penalty or whether it's going to be waved on. And it's just so hugely frustrating. And I'm very reluctant to, you know, use VAR more than what it needs to be. But if the technology is there, then surely someone should be saying, no, tell you what, you might just want to go and have a look at the screen of that one again, because there's a definite case here for, you know, for the shirt that's being pulled off Gabriel's back there, which it was, you know, it really was. And of course, and then the penalty changes the game, because if you score the penalty, Newcastle got to open up a bit more, becomes a far more evenly balanced contest, and the game becomes more enjoyable to watch. But yeah, I can totally get the frustration about that, because on another day with a different referee, it's a penalty.
And a different team, probably.
A different team, yeah.
There
yeah,
would be. Arteta's antics didn't go down too well with the media. There's lots of people criticising him for that, but it's the passion of the game. That's what you do. I mean, Jurgen Klopp goes running off and remonstrating with everyone. But Richard Keys is at it again. So I picked up one of his tweets. Seriously, when is someone going to get control of Mikel Arteta? He's an embarrassment, totally out of control during the game. And I said, shut up, for God's sake. Just admit to jealousy and obsession and we'll forgive you. Morality isn't your strong point, Richard Keys. So I gave him that back. Let's have a look at the player of the match for Newcastle. Bit of a mess, quite a hard one to pick out. Let's go with Lauren first.
God. I'm going to have to say Gabriel. I thought he was stellar. I thought he really, really put in a great performance defensively. Especially with Saliba, I suppose, kind of, you know, as I mentioned before, he's not really hitting the heights he was earlier on. So for me, it was Gabriel. I thought he was good. Attacking as well, he kind of was offering a bit more than we've seen. Tough one, though. Definitely a tough one. Not as easy as other weeks.
Yeah, I've not seen enough of the whole
kind of a scrappy match, really.
Yeah, I've not really seen enough of the whole match to give an informed comment on this one, to be honest. I mean, you can make a case for a few players for different. I mean, I thought Nkessi kept going on stuff from start to finish as well. He always made himself available, he was always out less. As you said, Lon, I thought Martinelli played well also. I thought Zaha did a good job in midfield once again. But if you ask me to pick an outstanding man of the match, I've really struggled to do that.
Well, I went for Thomas Partey because he really put in a shift. He's in the last few games been very impressive. Key tackles in key areas, winning the ball back once we've lost it, getting us moving again. And it just gives you that confidence that no one's going to breach the lines, although they did come close. But yeah, he was my standout. And had Odegaard not been performing as well in the last couple of matches, he probably would have picked up that then. So it's not the Martin Odegaard show, nearly. But up next, the outing to Oxford in the FA Cup. We'll cover that on a YouTube version only. It won't be on the audio. It'll just be on the YouTube. So, and thank you for your subscriptions. Subscriptions are up. Views are up. So it's all good stuff. But let's go to Lauren. They've not had a wonderful season. Have you spent much time sort of researching Oxford? It's a bit tricky with them. We're in a position where it's one of those away skirmishes that could go horribly wrong.
Yeah. Can't say I have spent much time this season thinking about Oxford now, to be honest, to be completely honest. What I am looking forward to hopefully
only did
is
it this morning, to be fair.
More than me, is hopefully the return of Smith Rowe. I mean, look, he's back in training, a little cameo. That's all we need. We just need some hope that we'll see him back in the Premier League soon. That would be great. You know what? Look, it's the FA Cup, isn't it? Look, we obviously went out of the other cup, what's that called? What's that called nowadays? Caribou Cup?
Caribou Cup, yeah.
We went out of that early on, and I don't think it's been that big a deal. FA Cup, obviously, is something that we put a bit more value into. Would like to see us go a bit further, but at the end of the day, when it comes down to a title race, we have Europe as well to contend with as well. It's fine. Whatever happens, happens. Let's just see Smith Rowe back and hope for a good result, but it's not the end of the world.
Paul, if you were Mikel, we're going to put you in the Mikel chair again. We did that last week, didn't we? If you were Mikel Arteta, wholesale changes with a few quality options on the bench. I don't know. You give Martinelli a rest and maybe bring in Marquinhos or just a few changes. Or would you go for, he's not going to make that mistake of about eight different players again, is he? I don't think we've got eight.
Yeah, I mean, I think
bring on the groundsman. Come on.
Well, bring your boots along, Tom. You never know.
My knee's a bit too dodgy for that, Mark. But obviously, we made that mistake against Forest, and it all went tits a loo-la. So, what would you do?
I think you need some kind of consistency within the team. So I think I'd be inclined to go for maybe three, four, possibly five changes at the maximum, but with the core of the team there and with the options on the bench, so that, you know, there's two ways you can go then, isn't it? You know, if Oxford have a performance far best than you expect, you can bring players off the bench to change it. But on the other hand, if you're struggling to a couple 2-3-0, when they take some of the experienced players off, gives you younger players an opportunity to shine in the first team as well. So I think, but yeah, I agree with you. I think to make 9-10 changes just doesn't work because the players aren't used to working with each other. Mm. And what you don't want is, after the draw of Newcastle, it gives some of the negativity a chance to fester if Oxford were to grab an unexpected cup win and puts additional pressure on the team. So I think you go there with maybe 50% of the normal regular team, make changes during the match, but you use the five substitutes, because Bob, you mentioned before about the lack of substitutions in the Newcastle game. This is an ideal opportunity to introduce substitutes into the match. And then to take it from there. I mean, Oxford United really don't pose a huge threat. They're kind of mid-table League One. They haven't.
We said that about Forest.
Yeah, but they were Championship, weren't they? So they were at a higher level. The Forest crowd was certainly a lot more specific to what Oxford United's crowd going to be. I mean, they've only got a three-sided ground. There's a car park behind on the go still. It's really bizarre ground. I mean,
it's a real shithole.
It's even worse than the Manning Ground. And that was pretty grim in the 80s anyway, you know, but at least I had some sort of atmosphere. So, yeah, but I really can't see anything other but than an Arsenal victory in this one. And you just want these games off the way. You don't get, there's still replays in the third round, isn't there? So the last thing you want is a replay. Just go there, get the job done, and then focus on, I think you're playing somebody quite close to you the weekend after that, aren't you?
Yeah, it's going to be one of those. Let's have some predictions. Paul, do you think we're just going to give it a clog and run off smiling?
Yeah, I think 2-0, 2-0, 3-0.
Yeah, I'll go 3-0. Lauren, I know you love this.
My favourite time of the day. Let's say...
I've missed this.
I'll go with 3-1.
3-1?
Yeah, why not? Spice it up a bit.
Guys, it's been absolutely brilliant to have you back. It's as I say, if you've got anything to say about Arsenal, if you want to ask any questions, send an email to itsanarsenalthing4@gmail.com. Please subscribe to the YouTube version, which you're currently watching. Also, like, follow and download the audio version, which is entirely different. Obviously, the gun room is in there, but it is an entirely different version. Guys, thanks ever so much. It's been an absolute pleasure again. And we'll see you on the next one.
Yeah, it's going to keep me down, huh? You can't keep me down, fam. I'm the best in the world. I'm the best of the best. Yeah, yeah.
MTCB.
Yo, I'm Grant Xhaka and I'm here to say I'm the best in the world, don't even contemplate. Arteta and his goons tried to get rid of me, but Kroenke intervened and said no siree. I'm a one man dynasty, yes siree. The Swiss Superman, you can't see me. I've been running that midfield for the last 5 years, but yet you pussyos don't even care. Wenger chose me over Kante. Secretly want to play Santi, and now he's with a scrumming Sambi. Who? Bitch, you really trying hard to act me. Let me say it carefully, I'm the best midfielder you ever see. Always screaming jealousy, he feeds me well internally. Acting like he's sick of me, don't even want to step to me. Wanna knock his country out, fam, I done impressively. Jacka 22, boy, we going clear. Fans in the stadium don't even fear. Just keep to yourselves and trust in me. AFTV man, watch your speech. Gotta shout out my man, Mr. DT. Been backing me since the start, wee. And now I step on the pitch and do my own thing, and dominate the Prem like it's my own bitch. Intensity, integrity, respect is what I'll bring. Gunners in the stadium, we'll have to stand and sing. Xhaka, we're sorry we mistreated you. There's no midfield in the world that can replace you. Better than Vieira, better than Arteta, better than Petit. I put them all to sleep, and at the end of the day, honestly, Granit Xhaka's Arsenal's MVP. Yeah. Xhaka, Laka, Saka, bitch. Yeah, my time, baby. I dominate that midfield. I run things, fam. It's my time. My time. Hit the like button. MTCB. Subscribe to the channel. You know what's going down, fam. Yeah, yeah. Come on.
Earlier on, we mentioned one cap wonders. Well, here's a little list myself and Dave compiled. Brian Talbot, 1980 one cap. Alan Sunderland, 1980 one cap. Jimmy Rimmer, great goalkeeper, 1976 one cap. Don't understand that. Jeff Blockley, I do understand, 1972 one cap. Francis Jeffers, I understand this even more. 2003, he got one cap. Brian Marwood, 1988 one cap. And the most capped player, David Safehand Seaman, 1991 to 2002, 72 caps, but you've only got one head. That's from englandstats.com. My thanks to Silent Dave. You can find him on Twitter as SilentDave101, and that's where you can also find Jay as the Bald Gooner. You can cozy up with Connor at ConnorJack2, Paul is at PMACCap, and Lauren is at LaurenD2710. The podcast is on every social media outlet, including Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. Please subscribe to the YouTube version and like and follow the audio version. Shout outs to Brandon Murphy, Dave Miller at Arsenal Attic, Simon Deasy at Gunners for Life, which is twin to the podcast. Look up arsedevils.com for the latest Arsenal news and opinions. A big thanks from the podcast team to all of you for your support and emails, whether you watch or listen. Every subscription and every follow counts. Until next time, look after yourself and each other, and remember, North London is most certainly red.